The material provided today is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered legal or financial advice. Consult with a financial professional for your own needs. John E. Sestina & Company disclaims any and all liability for the interpretation and use of the content provided today.
I need help getting out of my student loan debt.
I'm so worried. How am I going to afford taking care of my parents?
When's a good time to get into the market?
I'm really not sure when I should start taking my Social Security.
I wonder if I have enough insurance.
I wonder when I can retire.
It's time to talk about your money, managing to be wealthy. Our team of fee-only financial planners is ready to help you create better financial habits, envision your long-term goals, and understand money management better than ever. Our resident hosts of John E. Sestina & Company are on deck to show you the way.
Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Tracy Bennett. With me today are certified financial planners, Craig Konstantinovich and Spencer Hager. It's great to be back. It's good to see you guys. I kind of feel like it's been a while.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah. Don't make me laugh today. I'll start coughing.
No promises. No promises. We're talking about the good stuff today. Kids, college, education, yeah. All the grad parties are going to be starting. We're just making sure everyone's ready to go.
Yeah.
You guys actually
settle down, Craig.
You guys are a good duo to hold this conversation. We've got one that's got a little one at home that you're already probably starting the ball rolling.
And before she was born.
Getting ahead of the topic here. And Spence, you're newly married a year in, right? Going on two?
Yeah.
So this will be on the radar forthcoming.
Oh,
so,
I can't wait.
Yeah, get ready because it comes fast.
Yeah.
We're talking about college planning. It's college planning season. It's time to start thinking about if your child is interested in college, have those conversations, and it's a big part of our business. The certified financial planners deal with our clients every day, giving them advice and strategies to making this process easier and more tolerable, honestly, because it is very layered and intricate. So a lot to cover today. Let's get into it. Navigating college financial planning, readiness, debt management, all of those things. So the first question I have is, and maybe this is the cart before the horse, but let's talk about how we address this with our clients insofar as, one size fits all. We really don't have a one size fits all. It's a very personal conversation. A lot of people think everybody should go to college. But we have those conversations even in our staff meetings about how we want to address that. It's a very personal conversation. Mm-hmm. So if I can ask you, each of you, when you're dealing with someone who comes to you and says, I want to incorporate college planning into my financial plan, what is the first thing that you kind of put on their radar? Spencer, I'll start with you.
I guess to your question about what's on the radar, I guess my first question is always like, some parents have a particular school in mind to begin with. Some it's just super vague. It's ambiguous. It's, I know I want to fund something. I'm not sure how much. And then we kind of get into the mechanics. Others it's, I want to plan for Princeton, even if they don't go there. I want to plan for Stanford, something like that. That's a completely different starting point than someone coming to me and saying, I just know I want to save for some college, maybe not fully fund it. How do I go about doing it? So that's usually my starting point. And then we kind of home in from there.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, it comes down to, are you on track with the bigger goals? I mean, retirement, those kind of things. If you're not on track for retirement, again, as unfortunate as it may sound or may seem, you got to take care of yourself. Otherwise, you may have your kids taking care of you when you're in retirement. So is it, okay, I'm on track for retirement. Great, check that box. From there, then to Spencer's point, it's about, okay, well, do you have a preference as far as what school you would want to plan on attending, or do you have an idea, hey, are they going to be in state? Are they already talking about moving out of state? And depending on kind of where you're at, like for me, for instance, I'm not sitting down asking my almost two-year-old, hey, Gio, where do you want to go to school when you grow up? Because I'm just going to get blah, blah, goo, goo, gaga back as an answer. So I've taken it upon myself to at least just kind of start and say, well, let's assume that she ends up picking one of the public universities here in Ohio. So OU, Ohio State, Akron, some of those other bigger names or bigger metropolises, that's usually where you start. But that's oftentimes the least expensive option outside of community college or associate degrees or those kind of things. So that's kind of the first place that I start is, well, let's get something on track. And since we have absolutely no idea what's going to happen within the next 5 years, let alone the next 10, let's at least kind of develop something so that way we can get on track.
I'm sitting here listening, and I'm a visual listener. So I have friends who have taken different paths than even we did with their children. And college let's identify what does that mean. That could be community college. It could be state college. It could be, I mean, my gosh, there are other kinds of educations out there that are not technically college, but a 529, for instance, and I don't want to get too far ahead, but a savings account could fortify that need later, right?
Yeah, like trade school and those kind of things, too. Absolutely.
So how difficult is it when you have, because I know this was an emotional conversation in my house because of the way I was brought up. We always wanted to do more for our kids than was done for us. So, and it's very personal that way. That's why I said at the very beginning of the show, how do you approach the behavioral aspect and the emotional aspect of that entire, the start of that process? I mean, what do you encourage people to do other than looking at their financial plan currently to see if they've got all the buckets in place for their own personal existence? How do you handle that?
I mean, each case, you know, again, is all personalized. That's why no two plans are the same. That's why no two people are the exact same. So it really kind of starts out with, you know, what are your viewpoints on it? I mean, there are some people that I work with, both husband and wife are doctors. And they said, my kid's not going to college. They're going to go to a trade school because that's going to be the highest in demand position by the time they're getting out of school. So they're going to be able to charge whatever they want, kind of like, again, not that they're saying this technically, but kind of like I can do with my career. So there are those kind of thoughts that are out there, but it really just comes back to, you know, okay, how do you want to plan and prepare for it? And, you know, you mentioned 529, the famous numbers here. That right now is one of the best accounts to save for college in, but it started to get some more robust rules, some other alternative ways that it can be utilized. But for so long, so many people were hesitant to kind of open that account because of the misnomers, maybe the half-baked information that's been read as, you know, hey, I can only use this for college expenses. And that used to be true, but it's changed. So it used to be, hey, you could only use it for the state that you end up investing in or that you put the money into. That's since changed. It used to be you could only use it for secondary education expenses. That's changed. You can now use it for private K through 12 expenses in a lot of states. It used to be, hey, you're going to be penalized significantly if you take money out of this account and it's not used for college. Well, that's even changed here recently where under certain rules, you can essentially have the beneficiary start to fund retirement if there's money left over in that account. So a lot's changed even just within the savings stratosphere, and that's just the 529. Before the 529, there were other accounts like Coverdell Education Savings Accounts. Those are almost unheard of, unseen at this point, just because they are so restrictive on how you can use it, where the 529 plans create a lot more flexibility. So everything's always changing, and that's what we have to kind of articulate at first is, hey, what we're planning on today is what we know to be the best option right now. But it may not be the best option even in 5 years from now, but here's why this is as good of a tool as we can get.
Do you typically start when someone has a baby on the way, or do you wait until the child is older? At what point do you advise people to start thinking about this?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in, and I guess for this conversation, I'm just going to assume, like to Craig's earlier point, that there's cash flow to save above and beyond retirement. Those things are kind of in a good spot, and we're going to start with something.
Right.
Yeah, I would say as soon as, maybe not as soon as you know they're on the way. Part of it depends on when the due date is, because going back to the 529s, you can get some tax benefits depending on what state you're in by putting money into it, but that's a calendar year thing. It has to be by December 31st if you want your contribution to give you a deduction that year.
So grandma or grandpa can't open a 529 for a grandbaby that's not even on the map yet?
You can technically. You just can't name them as the beneficiary to start. So you can name, you know.
Yeah, you need a social security number for the beneficiary.
So technically, yeah, I could open one and I can name my wife as the beneficiary. And then when the baby's born, update it. So to your point, if, you know, baby's due in October, I usually say you don't have to rush out and open it, wait until they're born. If it's their due date's on December 28th, that puts you up against the gun. If you know you want to put something into an account to get started, you want the tax benefit, if it's a 529 that year, maybe do it before the due date, just to have it open. Otherwise, I say don't rush it. But yeah, the conversation, in my experience, starts the second we know baby's on the way.
Okay. Well, and it can even be sooner, too.
Sure.
I mean, there are some people that say, hey, I want to have two kids. Mm-hmm. Like, that's my goal. Okay, well, if you've got, to Spencer's point, the excess cash flow, yeah, start it now, list yourself as the beneficiary, and when they come along, because you still maintain ownership of that account, you have the autonomy to change who that account can benefit.
Is there a maximum contribution each year to an account like that?
It varies state to state. If you're looking strictly just for the state tax deduction, for Ohio, for instance, anything above $4,000, you're not going to get any more of a tax incentive for. I believe the rule, what, Spencer, you can do like a lifetime max at this point of $576,000 or something like that?
Yeah, and like per year, it's the same as the annual gift tax exclusion. So it's like $34,000 per child. And then to Craig's point, you can do multiple years at once, but then you're capped for that. So most people, it's $34,000, and that's more than enough for most people.
That's one type of account. I'm assuming that you can use an IRA or a Roth as well for education, or is that that? Can you use a 401k? I mean, what are some of the other tools that people can use towards education for their kids that they have in place for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you could use a plain Jane savings account. That's what some people do. They don't want to do the 529 for some of the reasons Craig mentioned. So you can just open up a savings account with a nice interest rate. It'll sit there and earn 4 or 5% based on current rates, and that could be earmarked for it. You're not getting any tax benefits for it. It's pretty cut and dry, right? It's just interest dedicated in your mind for their benefit. That's it. Usually I say the only downside with that is you're going to pay taxes on the interest that accrue every year, especially if that becomes a big balance, right? It's not in their name, so you're paying taxes. And then next one, you could do a Roth IRA. That people just have to be careful with how they invest the money, but you can put it into the account, grows tax-free. And if it's been in there for over 5 years, generally you can tap it and use it.
But again, it usually has to be for the account holder's education. So you would need a kid's Roth IRA, or you would need that kind of thing.
And then you need a social for those.
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
Right. But also the other piece too with IRAs, because it's a retirement account, you have to have earned income in order to even make a contribution towards it. So not many one-year-olds, unless you're a Gerber baby, but not many one-year-olds are out there slaving away and working to really get their actual income generated. So, you know, normally when you start talking about it, the 529 plan, a savings account, there's an UGMA, UTMA account, or basically a investment account where you can put money in, have it earmarked for your kid, but they can't have access to the money until they reach the age majority. Now,
what's that mean?
Well, it depends, but normally state to state, it's right around age 18.
Okay.
Basically, when someone's, in the eyes of the government, able to be an adult. So you could use that count. There's double E bonds and I bonds that are issued by the federal government that you can use. There's been so many tools that have come around for college savings within, the last 30 years that we always tend to find something that's better. So, for instance, we started out with double E bonds. That was, hey, use these. These are great. They'll double in value and they'll be available. You don't have to pay tax on the interest if it's used for education expenses. Oh, great, wonderful, but it's locked in at a guaranteed rate.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of went by the wayside. Then started coming about those UGMA, UTMA accounts, those custodial accounts. Those started to fall by the wayside because you relinquish control when you put money into that. So as soon as you put money in, that beneficiary gets to use it once they reach that age of majority, no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
The way they want.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for education?
Just for education. They can use it for anything.
So it sounds like the Cadillac would be a 529.
Yeah, I that's what I was going to jump in and say, because I feel like we throw out a lot there. I usually start with the 529, and then if people, some people, it could be for one reason or the other. It could be the penalties, or some people just don't want it to only be for education. They want it to be for a home down payment or starting a business. And then to Craig's point, once they get earned income, right, if it's babysitting, a paper route, whatever, then maybe we transition away from the 529 and start doing like a custodial Roth IRA that you can start to build that up.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my two preference points as opposed to the UGMA, UTMA savings account, but people can do their own research and land on that.
Okay, great. So now let's jump ahead a little bit. We get to be about freshman, sophomore age in high school. We start to have the conversations with the child, you know, what do you want to be the rest of your life? Which is very tough to do because it's some people it takes a lifetime to figure that out. But determining first if college is of interest, right? That's the first step. And then we go to, can we afford college? Do we have those things in place? And if we don't have those in place, what options are there? So if people don't have a whole lot saved, and their child wants to go to college and their retirement is intact, what options do they have to help their child go to college?
I mean, you can try and catch up and do the accounts we just talked about. I suppose that's number one. If you have nothing saved, if you don't have anything saved and you don't feel like you have the capability to save, then pretty much loans, right? And then start talking about what's the practical route going to be for mm-hmm. them going to college. And the other thing I always tell people to think about these days, it's a lot of kids graduate with a lot of credits, you know, if they're going to college out of high school. So even for people that start to save early, I almost have to try and sometimes reel them back a little bit because they say, you know, I only want to do public in state. If they go out of state or they go private, I'm only going to fund what would have been public in state. And I want to make sure we have all 4 years funded. And I almost have to reel people back and say, they may graduate with a year's worth of credits or more. And if you don't want that to go into like a starter retirement account for them, like Craig mentioned, you almost should kind of pull it back a little bit and try and have it not fully funded mm-hmm. to give yourself that leeway. So I'd say debt, if you can't save for it, if you can save, look at the other accounts you already mentioned and just start to have that conversation. Are they going to graduate with some credits so you don't overshoot the mark?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then we start looking at colleges. We look at community college, state college, out-of-state college. What were the other ones you were saying?
Private.
And private. Private. There was a trade schools,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, like flight school.
Yeah. I mean, I even know of a survivalist college on the East Coast that actually takes
yeah, of course you do.
Like, I'm a survivalist, but to have my lipstick with me. Okay, so let's talk about the loans for a second, because I think, at least in my experience, everybody was taking loans. Everybody mm-hmm. was, all the kids were taking loans, parents were taking loans. So let's talk about the different loan options for students and for parents. Let's talk about parents first. We have, what kinds of loans can they apply for their kids' college?
So you can start with, first things first, to figure out any kind of loan eligibility from the government or any kind of assistance, one of the forms that you're going to be filling out in advance is going to be the FAFSA form.
The what?
The FAFSA.
Yeah, I know. I'm getting hives thinking about the FAFSA.
I'm sure you
That's
are.
That's a fun process.
I know. But basically what that does is that helps determine, are you eligible for any kind of federal loans or federal support, whether that be grants, whether that be other scholarships, those kind of things. From there, the other piece too, before we even get to loans, is there's a lot of opportunities for scholarships that aren't necessarily publicized. So a lot of local credit unions tend to have some kind of scholarships. A lot of businesses tend to offer, you know, again, we're not talking about, hey, full ride scholarships,
right.
But, you know, $1,000 here, maybe a couple grand every couple years. Hey, anything helps at that point.
I know a kid who did that. I know my oldest was in school. A girl had scholarships, nickel and dime scholarships that
yeah.
actually paid for 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
She, you know,
it
wrote,
happens.
Wrote essays like crazy.
Yeah.
And got tens of thousands of dollars each year towards her education. It was insane. And
yep.
it was motivating.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you just have to do a little research. Is there a place people can go to find those? Or
There's a website out there. I can't remember it off the top of my head at this point. But mm-hmm. there is some kind of a database that does help you kind of realize that. And,
yeah.
again, different requirements to apply and those kind of things. But
Google can help with that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't remember it either. But I think if you literally put in, like, college scholarships for juniors or sophomores, whatever it is, it'll pull something
right.
up.
Right. Well, and then I won't belabor the point here too far, but once you get past that scholarship side, there's the unconventional loans, if you will, so not specific to college education that you can use. And then I'll pass it to Spencer for some of the more traditional parent education loans that are out there. But people truly do use a cash-out refinance to help out with college expenses. They'll use a home equity line of credit. They'll use a personal line of credit. Like, they will use other tools that are out there. Not that we would recommend it, but I can't tell you how many times people have come to us and, you know, they're where I would think they would be paying down their debt for their house, and all of a sudden it's, hey, we've got, you know, $300,000 on a $500,000 house, and no, we didn't just move. We've been there for 20 years. I needed to take that money out to help out with my kids' college mm-hmm. expenses. So it does happen. And, you know, whether that be loans from 401ks or those kind of things, again, not the preferred route. Those are options that are out there.
Well, what happens, and let's just kind of juke, because we have this conversation a lot at the office. If somebody comes to you and says, I want to borrow against my 401k to pay my kids' college, what does that look like? What does that entail?
I mean, first and foremost, I would tell them no, because basically you're taking money out of an interest-bearing opportunity.
But I want my child to go to college. I didn't get to go to college. I want them to have everything that I didn't have.
And here is my favorite.
I have it, so why can't I give it to them?
Here is my favorite thing to put back into people's perspective. Hey, Tracy, you know what? There is no rule against you helping your kids out with their college loans after they graduate. Absolutely nothing in the rule book that says you can't offer assistance, you can't double their payments, nothing like that. Oh, I guess I've never really thought about that. That's where I try to come from as well.
So, moral of the story is have the kids take the loans and then the parents contribute to the loan payments.
As much as possible,
gotcha.
Yeah.
What about veterans, children of veterans? Is there opportunity for that? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, usually if you're active or in the military, then you can pass on. I think it's 3 years of education mm-hmm. that you can fully. Okay. It's the GI Bill, right? So you can cover education for children, depending on if both parents were in the military, just one. So that can cover a big part of it right there.
And for adults who are going back to school, if they are in the sector where the public sector, there are oftentimes tuition compensation programs for them?
There's a lot that's changed here. We could honestly do an entire show just on some of the changes that have come here recently. But, yeah, a lot of businesses are offering tuition reimbursement. A lot of businesses are incentivizing you to pay more towards your student loans by making matching 401k contributions. There's, again, more changes that have happened within the last 3 years than almost the last 20 years in this. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there are other options. There are other ways that you can go about that. But you definitely got to see what your employer has to offer. And, you know, as you are getting ready for school, to kind of bring it back to, hey, what kind of loans are out there for parents? One of the other big government loans that's out there strictly for education is called a Parent Plus loan. And basically what that's looking at is, hey, I understand that your child may not be creditworthy enough to sign up for debt on their own. So parents will take the debt out, but it tends to follow some of the same rules. So you may defer your payments until the student's graduated. You may have loans that aren't necessarily accumulating interest while the student is still in school, only afterwards. There are some other flexibilities that come out there, but whenever possible, you want to have your student take on the debt, not you take out the debt on behalf of the student.
Yeah, I was going to just, a couple like easy basics to Craig's point, like subsidized versus unsubsidized. So the unsubsidized interest starts accruing the second you take out the loan. Subsidized, you wait until you graduate and then you start to pay and interest accrues. Most people get unsubsidized, but subsidized is obviously preferred. That's just you see what you get once you get through the FAFSA program. You can do fixed rate versus variable rate interest, right? Just like anything. You can also do private student loans, right? You don't have to go through the federal government. You could go to another loan provider and see if you can get a better deal. You give up some flexibility with that, though, compared mm-hmm. to the
give
federal
up some
government.
Of the goodies, too, don't you? If there are any, the
Usually,
offered
I think,
by the government?
Yeah, usually with the federal loans, what I always jump to, less about the interest rates, it's when you graduate. What's your repayment structure going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
With the federal loans, usually you get some leeway. They have income-based repayment plans. So if you graduate and you're only making $35,000 to start, they're not going to give you a monthly payment like you're making $150 per year. Whereas with the private loans, generally you're a little bit more locked in on the repayment. There's less flexibility with trying to lower that payment. And then, the fixed versus variable rate. I mean, everyone's seeing that right now. If you had a variable rate 3 years ago, probably looked great. Right now, it probably looks horrible. You're probably like 8 to 10%, just mm-hmm. like a lot of other things.
Wow. Okay, let's jump ahead. So we've filled out the FAFSA. We know what we qualify for. Child takes out their loans, parent plus loans, personal loans, whatever the parent decides to do. Kids getting ready for college. What are some of the financial challenges the student is going to face once they get to college? Even though their tuition might be paid, what other kinds of things should we be thinking about monetarily?
I mean, obviously, life happens outside the classroom. So, I mean, you got to have walking around money, as people say. You got to be able to spend a little bit. Thankfully, they've cut back on it a lot. It used to be, the old school thought of, hey, as soon as you move on to campus, here's every single credit card company out there trying to rush at you. But a lot of that has been subsided because people were misinformed, people weren't getting all the information that they needed. But usually that is a time where you really start to utilize credit for the first time, and you may not be working, you may be focusing on your studies, you may need to find a part-time job of some sort. But the biggest thing, this is where you really start to develop some of your money habits. So you really got to be careful with what it is you're doing and really trying to keep a pulse on things.
I'm just cracking up thinking if John was on the show, he would just get a job and be done.
Yeah,
with it.
But, that would be it. Get a job. Get two jobs.
Not encouraging people to take on more in loans. I guess the only thing I would say is depending on the agreement between the parents and the you know children going to college. If it's truly the child's the one footing the bill on everything outside of tuition, when you take out the loans, if you're not going to be able to work a job in addition to going to school, then don't only take out a loan for what the bare minimum is to cover the tuition bill. To Craig's point, make sure you have enough money to cover the lifestyle. I'm not saying go take out massive loans to live a lavish lifestyle in college, but don't just only do the tuition payment and room and board and then have to scrap for
room
the rest.
And board looks different for freshman, sophomore year than it does junior, senior year, too.
Well, it depends on the college. Sometimes there are those. Some people choose to commute. Some people, again, go to community college. Again, there's no fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, there's not the same traditional college route that everyone goes through at this point. There's a lot of different hoops and hurdles. There's a lot of different ways that people make it work because, in all honesty, college expenses have been one of the true steadfast inflationary items that we've seen over the last 40 years. It's almost been at an exact 6% interest incline for, again, almost the past 40 years at this point that expenses keep going up, up, and up. And right now, it doesn't seem like there's anything that's going to stop that from happening because we all keep paying it. Mm-hmm. We all keep going to college, and they keep on adding on things, whether that be new facilities, whether that be new programs or new career paths or new areas of study, those kind of things. So,
and I think, too, something else to consider as a non-CFP, just as a parent, when your child first hits the pavement and you say goodbye and they start meeting with their advisor, make sure that the credit hours that they are advising them to take match and can work with the opportunity to work to make income while they're going to school, because that can really throw things off and throw a student into debt. And I mean, we laugh about it, and I guess the bottom line is get a job. But you know, you've got so many credit hours on your schedule, you really can't get a job. So the lesson is to be very aware of how many hours there are in the day, mm-hmm. right? What the study week looks like, and what the opportunities are to earn income, and what kind of jobs are on campus too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I was actually going to take it back a step, and I always tell people, and I feel like we kind of glazed over it to some extent, like when you start to have that conversation freshman, sophomore year, like to the best of your ability, if you're the parents, I would just, as much as you're comfortable with, lay it out on the table, because I think people would be surprised how much it drives what kids want to do with going to college based on what they expect to be there. Right, if you're coming into college with the expectation that you're on your own to begin with, you're probably going to go about it a completely different way than if you are under the impression that you've got 4 years of public in-state covered. If that's the case, that's fantastic.
Right.
So to Craig's earlier point, too, about, you know, hey, we're going to do what we can to help out when it's done, but we can't guarantee anything. That's going to drive a lot. So just air it out.
Great point. Yeah. Great point. Let's talk about outlining some potential long-term impacts of the student loan debt on post-graduation financial goals. What's that look like? What steps can graduates take to kind of create a budget that accounts for their current expenses and future debt obligations? Because, I mean, that's something this whole generation is looking at, right, with the student loan debt.
Yeah, I mean, an ideal answer would be map it out before you even start to take it on, right, because then you think critically about how much debt you take on. But, I guess more practically, if you're, you know, 6 months, a year out from graduating, most people, you start to interview, start to see what your job situation is going to look like, and then develop a budget, right? I mean, you should factor in what the student loan payment is going to be, and you should be able to figure that out based on the interest rates and everything else. How big of, you know, based on your job, first job out of college, and what your income set to be, how large is that student loan payment? What percentage does that represent of your monthly income? And then you should use that really as the, you know, starting point to say, okay, what can I even afford to spend on other things? And which most people forget, obviously we come to the table with, it is you know, try and factor in some savings. You shouldn't be all dollars spent with no savings.
Just some savings, Spencer? Yeah, right. Come on now.
I would say at least 10% is ideal, but that, you know, don't factor in I'm going to get to break even every month and clean the student loans with no savings, right? Because then you're setting yourself up for disaster. One unexpected expense hits you. So
yeah,
just start working on a budget.
Yeah. And you mentioned other goals or other things. I mean, you know, not that you're necessarily going to know exactly, hey, here's where I want to go, when I want to retire, those kind of things. But, you know, normally one of the first goals that people are talking about when they graduate, I can't wait to get my next car. I can't wait to buy a house. Like, those are the ones that are there. But you got to remember, when lenders are looking at, hey, can I offer an additional loan? They're usually starting to evaluate that based off of your debt to income ratio. So to Spencer's point, knowing what you're going to make as soon as you're out of school and as soon as you have that paycheck coming in, they're going to look at it and say, well, if you're only bringing in $3,000 a month, but you're paying $1,000 a month in student loans, you're paying another, you know, $1,500 in rent, you can realistically afford $500. That's not going to be enough for us to really get where we need to go. And, you know, hey, we can't offer you a $30,000 loan at this point to buy that new car, or we're not going to accept your offer for a $450,000 house.
Right.
So you got to understand that, yeah, until you do kind of get past that, you may need to delay some of the other goals that you've got.
Emotional stuff, that behavioral finance that we love to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So primal, and nobody wants to face that. It's in all of us. We learn a lot about that at John E. Sestina Company. The opportunity to repay. So a couple of things. I actually know somebody who defaulted on their loans, lost a job, defaulted on their loans, and then did not pay them, and the university revoked the diploma. So pay your loans. Mm-hmm. You have to get a second job. You know, keep the credit cards away. You know, control your spending.
Well,
behavioral stuff.
And the biggest thing too is just understand that a lot of these lenders know that hard times can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, COVID was a great example of that for a lot of people. Now, you know, immediately ceasing student loan payments, I'm not here advocating for that. But, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, if you do lose your job, they want to eventually get paid. Mm-hmm. So call them, file for something called forbearance, basically saying, hey, I don't have the income right now.
You're in my head. That's the next question, right?
It's like I'm prepared for this.
It's almost like you're reading my outline. I want to give people different opportunities for repayment options. So mm-hmm. let's go through those.
Yeah. So forbearance is the first one. And that's, you know, literally the example that we were saying, hey, I lost my job. I can't keep everything at this point. I've got a little saved up to keep me afloat till I get my next job. Can I miss the next, you know, 3-4 months worth of payments? Literally, that's an option that's available within the loans.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one route that you can go. Now,
Spencer's,
obviously, no one wants to be there, but
Spencer's got a look on his face.
Repayment options. Well, first, you cannot pay.
All right. Well, then, where would you like to go then next with repayment options?
I guess, again, it depends on, is it private versus federal? If it's private, it's pretty straightforward, right? You choose a certain year amount, and that's what you're paying it based on. And it probably was selected when you took out the loan. So it could be 5 years, 10 years, and you're taking the current loan balance with some interest accrued on top of that, and that's going to continue to accrue, and you're pretty straightforward, same monthly payment. It's a lot more convoluted with the federal side of things. That's when you can get into just standard year term repayment, so 10 years, 20 years, you know, 25 years. And then there's the income-based repayment plan, which, again, it depends on what your income is and what you can afford, but that generally could lower the payment depending on what your income is and the size of your loans. There's different types of income.
Adds interest, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, and then you can even these days, and that's it, there's, you know, legislation going back and forth on it all the time, or executive orders, but you can even get to the end of 25 years, and if you don't pay back your student loans based on income-based repayment, it could be forgiven, but then you have to pay taxes on what's forgiven. So mm-hmm. it's not like you're absolved, congratulations, you made it 25 years. It's you're absolved, but mm-hmm. you're still going to have to pay some sort of tax bill on this. So.
Yeah, and if it's $100,000 that's still outstanding, that may thrust you into an entirely different tax strategy.
Yeah, exactly. But to your initial point, just the different types, there are a lot on the federal side, less with private.
And the other big one, too, and income-based repayment plans play into this, but biggest thing is if you are going to work in the public sector, if you're going to work for, you know, the government, if you're going to work for
a local school district,
local hospital, those kind of things.
Police department, fire,
those, you can usually qualify for public student loan forgiveness. So as long as you put in your 10 years of service, you make your qualifying payments all 10 years. You know, if you've got $130,000 and you pay back $35,000 over 10 years, well, guess what? You get the remaining $95,000 that's going to be forgiven at that point.
Yeah, the crazy part of that, and I'm going to point this out because someone may know someone who they think they're going to do that. All those COVID payments where you were under forbearance and you weren't supposed to, you didn't have to pay, those technically counted as qualifying payments. You know, do your own application, double check. But a lot of people thought because they weren't paying all those years, you weren't getting credit. But yeah, you 99% sure you did. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about consolidation?
It can be an option. It just kind of depends on where things are at. I mean, to Spencer's point, if you're working with an unsubsidized loan and, you know, the monthly payment is something that's reasonable, yeah, you deferred or you had the interest that accrued on it and you deferred making payments until everything was done. But, you know, it really just comes down to what are your financial means at that point and how are you trying to pay this off? Because loan consolidation, you know, let's say that you're in the private sector right now, but you do want to end up getting to the public sector or you think that that's a possibility. Well, yeah, it may not be necessarily the most exciting thing, but you could also then qualify for public student loan forgiveness. But if you don't have public loans and instead you privatize them because you refinance, well, you're kind of SOL.
Yeah.
So you got to take it with a grain of salt. It's absolutely an option. That's how some of the largest lenders in the game right now really got their catalyst to take off. But yeah, I mean, you know, buyer beware, just like anything at that point.
Yeah, I'd just say with the current interest rate environment, it's probably not a one-time check and then never revisit again. Like two, three years ago, you could refinance your student loans potentially and your interest rate, you know, for a 5-7 year loan repayment would have been 3-4%, and federal loans were 6-7%. That makes a really big difference. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you refinance it, there's no way you're getting 3-4% that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Okay. But rates are going to fluctuate again. So even if it doesn't make sense to do it now, it could make sense in 1 year, 2 years from now, depending on how long you're going to hold the loans.
Power of compound interest. We talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm. And cash flow, right? I mean, yeah, that's the huge piece, is mm-hmm. lowering your monthly payment and still going after those loans.
Right. Lots of resources. This is what we do every day. So it's kind of, to me, it's sometimes a very large chess game. Mm-hmm. And everybody, there's no one size fits all. So the takeaway is, you know, do your research, seek the help of the professional. This is what we do. We would love to talk to you. If you're interested in a complimentary consultation, feel free to give us a call and we'll sit down with you for an hour and go through your questions and concerns and see if we can give you some tips and strategies. We appreciate you tuning in. We hope you'll come back. We are Managing to Be Wealthy.
That's a wrap for today's episode of the Managing to Be Wealthy podcast. We help you make the most of your money without any hidden fees or commissions. Remember, the best investment you can make is in yourself and your financial future. Keep listening for more expert advice and tips. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. To schedule a 1 hour complimentary consultation to discuss your financial concerns, visit our website, managingtobewealthy.com.